Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, join me, Jeremy Mags, as I explore some of the issues and ideas shaping our world with key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. Coming up on our program today, a unionist hits out at government for dragging its feet over the Stilfontein mining disaster. Lessons that South Africa should be learning from the destruction caused by the California wildfires. Despite all the drama at SA Tourism, the country's marketing arm says it is on track in terms of budget and spending. And a look at the new world of work and what's been called sunrise sectors. It's Friday, the 17th of January. With a degree of shame, horror, and I guess disbelief, we're all still digesting the Stilfontein mining tragedy. In case you don't know, 78 miners are confirmed dead, 248 have been rescued, many in a horrific state, while an unknown number remain underground, possibly lost forever. This tragedy follows a police crackdown under Operation Vala Mgodi, a government-led campaign against so-called artisanal miners. So I think the question we need to be asking now, was this preventable? Who ultimately is responsible? And what does it say about our government, the mining industry, and general law enforcement? And in that respect, I'm joined now by Mametlwe Sebe, president of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa. A very warm welcome and thank you for joining us. The government has framed this operation as a crackdown on illegal mining. You argue it was a death sentence for those underground. Why are you saying that?
Thank you, Jeremy, and pleased to be here. Absolutely, yes. Firstly, let's get to the facts. But before I start there, I mean, this is arguably the worst, mass murder of, miners due to state actions and series of decisions since the dawn of democracy. Worse than massacres, Marikana massacre, both in terms of numbers, but also the nature of death, just the cruelty of it, because what these miners suffered is months of deprivation of food, water, and medication, being trapped underground. So they died, a very slow, painful, and just too ghastly a death to even contemplate. And that is what really has happened here. What transpired is that the state, knowing that at shaft 11, it is 2 to 3 kilometer hole without a staircase, without a lift, and that these miners, basically without anybody on the surface, pulling them through a pulley system that is actually a manual rope that used to take the miners down and out of the mine. And it was also that very same system that was used to ensure a supply of food, water, and medication. The state and the police arrived there, simply chasing away the people from the surface, and waited that on that hole for miners that are located somewhere at 1.6 kilometers and 1.8 kilometers for months without supplying them with food, water, and medication, but also ensuring that there's any means of, these miners being put up. And they lied about these miners having option to come out of other shafts. The shaft where lots of miners have come out, that is Margaret shaft. That shaft does not even belong to that mine. It's not connected to the shaft. The only other shaft that is connected to shaft 11 is shaft 10 of the same mine. On average, it takes 7 days of miners crawling underground in dark, narrow, flooded tunnels. And many of the miners, by the way, died on the way there from falling, but also drowning in those flooded areas and so on.
Let me ask you this question. What do you say to government then that asserts that they were criminals and they need to be treated as such?
Well, I mean, let's be clear of what we are dealing with here. There are two levels to basically this industry of artisanal mining. One is people that are crushed by poverty, many of whom are former miners, they are families and communities that are abandoned by the big corporate mining companies. That is true of Buffersfontein mine. That is true of over 6,000 other mines in this country that are abandoned, derelict and ownerless. And when these big companies are abandoning these mines, it's not only that they are leaving holes that are not sealed, environment that is not rehabilitated, meaning it can be used for other alternative productive uses, amusement, housing, agriculture. You mentioned all of that. They abandon the miners along with their families and, of course, communities in a dire conditions of poverty and unemployment.
Your union is now calling for a commission of inquiry. What specifically do you want investigated, and what accountability measures do you believe should follow that?
We do think that there's a case to be, you know, investigated here for a criminal liability, charges and accountability of those that were responsible for the death of these miners in the way that they carried out the police operation. We do also believe that there's got to be discussion about what we do about the explosion of artisanal mining that is unregulated, but also because of lack of regulation, lack of access to equipment and access to market. This industry is being hijacked by organized criminal syndicates. We've got to be able to deal with those issues. We've got to deal with the legacy of abandoned and derelict mines. We've got to deal with the conditions of dire poverty and unemployment, particularly in distressed mining towns affected by closed mines. Many of these mines still have substantial deposit of minerals, actually over 2,000, according to government, when I was doing the research in this field and so on. If these mines are reopened, recapitalized, they can create hundreds of thousands of jobs. We need to begin to make inroads in elimination of unemployment and ending of a crushing and devastating levels of poverty, which in this country have reached level of hunger and starvation that is forcing some of the former miners to work in this horrific condition.
How would you suggest that artisanal mining be regulated, given its often unknown and patchy nature?
No, it is very simple, Jeremy. There is over 100,000 miners in this country that are actually using rudimentary equipment to salvage the residual minerals that are left by the big mining company. It's very simple. In many countries, in fact, the history of mining here began as an artisanal mining. It's only that, obviously, it was later on monopolized by big companies and the legal framework was ordered in that. What you do, there is regulatory a framework in other jurisdictions that we can refer to that would legalize and make it possible for group of miners to form cooperatives and to be able to apply for license. The state can assist them with equipment to ensure that they mine safely, but also productively so that they earn decent earnings for themselves, their families, as well as to contribute to sustainability of
the
local.
The problem with your argument, of course, is that government is not interested in doing that.
But I'm saying that you can also then create a state buyer. When you do that, by the way, not only are you going to address the issue of taxation and boost to the fiscus, right? You will dispense with organized criminal syndicates that have monopolized the trade, that are extorting the minerals from these particular miners. And to do that, they have unleashed a reign of terror on these miners, their families, their communities. When you hear outrage about Zamazamas, the stories of rapes, of murders, is this organized criminal syndicates, which I must say, by the way, they work in conspiracy with the elements of the state, particularly the police, but also the big companies. Let me just make an illustration. The idea that you could have these poor, emaciated, dehydrated miners that you saw coming out of the Stilfontein, transporting gold on their own from Stilfontein, but also some platinum all the way from Limpopo to the borders of Zimbabwe to Durban without the state and the police involvement is not realistic.
I am going to leave it there. Regrettably, we are out of time. But thank you very much indeed for a very blunt and forthright assessment. That is Mametlwe Sebe, president of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, wildfires are no longer just a seasonal threat. They're becoming a national crisis. We've all witnessed the ongoing situation in Los Angeles in the United States. Recent fires in the Western Cape have destroyed homes, claimed lives and disrupted communities, and fire incidents nearly doubling in December last year compared to the previous year. That is a clear sign that climate change is fueling more frequent and intense blazes. Experts are now warning that if we don't act now, we could face a Los Angeles-level wildfire disaster sometime in the near future. So what needs to change? How can we better prevent, detect and fight those fires? Someone who's applied his mind to that is Volker van Verden, Principal of Strategic Risk at RiscoNet Africa. So Volker, fair to say that fires are becoming more intense, more frequent. What is driving the surge in activity, not only in South Africa, as I mentioned, but also in the United States?
Hi, Jeremy. The principal reason is that the environment is becoming hotter, drier and significantly more windy.
You've compared our fire risks to those in Los Angeles, and we're all witnessing what is going on there at the moment. Are there any specific lessons that we can learn from that experience that that might inform a better strategy as far as we're concerned here?
Yes, I think there are a few. I'm trying to get them through. I might have to come back to one or two points. What the lessons are from the start is that we need to think about how did it get, inverted commas, out of control, inverted commas. And how is it that the fire resources or prevention resources were so restricted or compromised or, you know, couldn't really deal with it? So if you look at it from that side as one of the angles, and then say, well, example, as a risk management measure, they switch off the power because they want the power lines to cause further issues. And then because the power switched off, the water capacity is reduced or is not available. So surely that's the thinking. If you know that you're going to do that and you're going to disable the very resource that you need to fight the fire, what is plan B? Now, they haven't thought about this for 1 month. This has been part of a 5-10 year strategy of having to, looking at protecting the environment. So that means that you need an alternative strategy to keep the resources available for, you know, highly risky fires, for which we have great sympathy for them and their exposures. But there are practical and straightforward ways in which you address it, saying, yes, we will switch off the transmission lines, but it means that we need water reservoirs, we need standby generators, we need independent fuel sources just for fire prevention and different kinds of water provision under those circumstances. Not maybe complex and so forth, but look at the $20-30 billion of losses that have happened now. And surely $1 billion of provision for this kind of strategy would make a huge difference to that environment. So just looking at it from the point of view of saying, how does this whole catastrophic scenario play out? And what would we do if we have a good solid 5 to 10 years to plan for it? What would we do better? And I think in that context, there's a lot of good solutions that are available. The next major theme is technology. So how is it that it got so bad? How we got down that road? Why was it like that? And one obviously has to identify the unusual. Unfortunately, there have been reports of some arson. But either way, if we're in a hot, dry season, now again, hot and dry and windy is not the biggest surprise in the world. It's the most obvious thing to measure. So now we, let's say, call a risk index. If the wind is higher than 30 miles an hour for California miles, and the temperature is above 30 degrees, and where we haven't had rain, they should have had 5 inches of rain. They only had 0.5 inch. So we are in extremely risky circumstances. We have the combination of that, and we deploy technology like crazy to watch what may be happening. We don't wait for the fires to spark up. We've got to fly in there as quickly as possible with a very high level of technology. Maybe we rent a couple of satellites to look at it for us. But that way of being super responsive when risk conditions increase is the second key theme. The third key theme, and there will be more, will be control of your environment. So that runs from vegetation and all those kind of things to saying, hey, how clever it is it to keep a house that was built from wood 50 years ago, acknowledged, when maybe weather conditions or other things were safe enough. And now we've got wooden houses in hot and dry and windy areas where sparks fly everywhere and so forth. So what about starting to clad the houses with fire-resistant materials. And so one would go down that whole road and saying, I can make a house 10 times more fire-resistant by cladding it in one or other way. And all of these measures can be incrementally applied over many years, but have not. Mm.
Volker, I want to take you back to your first point, and you were referencing a multi-stakeholder approach. I'm wondering to what extent we fail in the coordinated strategy as far as that is concerned. And in a situation like that, whether it be in Los Angeles or South Africa, who takes the lead?
Okay, so the first part is that very often risk management is seen as transactional. In other words, we'll call the fire department when we have to, or we've got a great relationship with Pete up the road. And we say, yeah, but when that happens, Peter's got to be in 20 places at once. It's just never going to work. So there's very little deep level and thinking and scenario planning for what is involved. Now, if you look at who takes the lead, we have obviously a social impact because we have a local authority, and we have a community and a commercial impact because that's a lot of the property that's going to be at risk. So, you know, one would at least need those two or three major community and social groups to get together and saying, what is our emergency fire and risk management plan? So it's got to involve those people on a collective basis. And we can't just moan that there's no water in the fire hydrants. We have to say, under certain circumstances, we need alternatives, and how are we going to develop these better equipped, more responsive disaster response plans over time? So, I mean, it can't just be the fire department because they don't control the resources around the country or that region. They're just given limited resources, and unfortunately is hardly ever enough.
Just a final one. Do you think, again, in this country, government and industry are taking the risks that you've outlined seriously enough? And do we need immediate policy changes that would make a quick impact?
Yes, we do need policy changes. And no, it is not being taken seriously enough. And this is where perhaps accountability and liability should be part of the, you know, the rod that pokes people into better behavior. You know, if we just kick this tin down the road and we do not put better policy in place, who's accountable? Who should be sued for damages? Who's responsible for a raging fire that could have been caught a lot faster? And whether it's on Table Mountain or somewhere else, how do we get the resources in place quicker, faster, you know, better and more effective to make sure that there's a limitation of unexpected losses? And I think that accountability and that process is something that then gets to better policy. And the policy should be informed by regional disaster risk management plans, mobile resources that can fly around, helicopters or technology or otherwise, and incremental investments in infrastructure and assets that will protect the areas that we're looking at, including, you know, with technology or water reserves or otherwise. So that's the policy change that would be needed. And if people don't do that, they're frankly being reckless.
I'm going to leave it there. Volker von Verden, Principal of Strategic Risk at RiscoNet Africa. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, tourism is one of the country's biggest economic drivers, bringing in billions and creating jobs. But here's the question. Is South African tourism doing enough to maximize its impact? Latest numbers show a solid recovery, something in the region of 7.2 million visitors between Jan and October last year, a strong festive season demand. Yet, budget spending has come under scrutiny. A reported 72% of the budget spent by December, and critics are asking, why isn't the full budget being utilized? Is procurement perhaps a bottleneck? And is South African tourism missing opportunities to market South Africa a little bit more assertively? I want to talk now to the Chief Marketing Officer of South African Tourism, Thembi Sehloho. Thembi, a very warm welcome, and let's get straight to it. You've seen the report saying just over 70% of your budget has been spent. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. Thank you for the time, Jeremy, and the opportunity to be able to clarify. So if I just take you back, the initial reports were saying we haven't spent, like, I think over 90% of our budget at this rate. But as of December, we had spent 72% of our budget, which is on track. I mean, we do have some activity that we have in this quarter. So it's really about how do we then spend the rest of the budget compliantly, because this is our last quarter. So if you look at it, you know, quarterly spend, we really are on track in terms of where we are from a spend perspective.
I'm glad you used the word compliance, because one of the criticisms leveled not only at South African tourism, but other departments, is the money may be approved by the board for certain projects, yet often is held up by procurement. For instance, the appointment of a global marketing agency is still ongoing as far as SAT is concerned. Is there an issue here? Does that whole process need to be streamlined?
We have a process that we follow, but obviously if there is anything that's flagged within the process, we have to make sure that we investigate that and make sure that we, whomever we appoint, we don't have, we get on with the work of doing tourism rather than looking at whether compliance was being followed to get there. So global marketing agency procurement, that's still in progress. With that said, it does not mean that the work of marketing doesn't continue, because we have country teams that are doing the work. We have a brand strategy that's in place. So we are using that to ensure that we still implement the work of marketing within the countries. And I mean, domestic spend has, we've spent well in the domestic market as well. I mean, you've seen the short left campaigns that we've done. So the work of marketing doesn't necessarily come to a grinding halt, because we are still procuring for a global creative marketing agency. We've got a digital agency, we've got activation, we've got other spectrums of marketing tools that we can pull to drive marketing. But it is important that we have one in place, and we are fast tracking the procurement there.
You say that you're optimizing your budget, that you are on track at the moment, but even any kind of underspending, doesn't that automatically imply missed opportunity? In other words, are we losing potential visitors maybe because the execution is a little too slow?
The numbers are not telling us that. I mean, marketing is, it's quite fluid, and we move with the trends and what's happening. You have a plan at the beginning. So if there's a bottleneck in executing that particular plan, you optimize on other opportunities. We are constantly looking at new opportunities that we can capitalize on to drive the country brand and ensure that, people are always seeing us and the awareness of the brand is always out there. I mean, there's a lot happening on digital influencer marketing. So there's a lot of other areas which we pull on. I'm not going to say that you don't get into bottlenecks next, where you are saying, oops, I want to do this, but I can't do it. But you have to look at another way. If the objective is to drive awareness, you look at another angle that you can use to do the same work so that you can optimize on the spend and get the ROI that you're requiring.
So let's talk about those new opportunities, if we can. What are the key marketing priorities for 2025? Your job, I imagine, is to ensure that this country stands out globally. But I don't need to remind you that the global tourism market has become increasingly competitive, very cutthroat, in fact.
Highly competitive. So we are operating in a highly, highly cluttered market. Everybody is really fighting for the share of mind with the consumers. And, hence the job of a global brand marketing agency is to ensure that we stand out from that clutter. We are on trend in terms of what's happening within the, the tourism space and what our competitors doing that we're not optimizing on, like how we're using digital as a tool. So if I go back to, what is our priorities, we really want to continue to market South Africa and drive it as a preferred destination. Through our people, which is, we have amazing cultures in this country, our places, we've got beautiful landscapes and our ways, culture is beautiful. Amapiano. So looking at other pillars in terms of assets that we can pull to drive the brand forward. And then the other area that's quite important is participation into meetings and events. So you do know, in terms of our 2029 target, we are looking to generate about 616 million rands back into the economy through our meeting and events. So that's quite an important pillar for us to pull. I mean, we've got Meetings Africa happening now from the 24th to the 26th of February. So that's quite an important space from an events and meetings perspective. And we obviously want to grow the impact of tourism in the economy and increase our GDP contribution to the economy. I mean, the president spoke in his first newsletter about the importance of tourism and how it drives the economy. And in an economy where jobs are scarce, it is quite, an easy economy to get into and play in it. So, but again, driving that.
What the president doesn't say is that while South Africa is a premium global tourism destination, you will concede that issues like crime, infrastructure, and even visa challenges persist.
Yeah.
For instance, Johannesburg is not covering itself in glory at the moment, and we are a major gateway. How do you counter those negative perceptions when it comes to your marketing outreach?
Yeah, so I'm not going to say we don't have challenges. So does many other countries. I mean, if you look at Brazil, they have similar challenges to us. But our job from a marketing perspective, there is a PR leg of it where we drive sentiment and we partner with right custodians to help us drive that sentiment. And moreover, there is the sentiment and there's what we're doing on the ground. We partner with the private sector to ensure that our tourists are safe when they arrive in the country. So there's a lot of work in terms of partnership. So the whole tourism economy is not really just SA Tourism by itself. We have to have partners with our stakeholders to make sure that the ecosystem of tourism is actually working and it's working efficiently. I always say it's not just about tourists being safe in this country. We also have to feel safe as citizens of this country. So the job of safety is it's a universal job for South Africa.
Thank you very much for joining me today. That's Thembi Sehloho, Chief Marketing Officer at South African Tourism.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's youth unemployment crisis, I don't need to remind you, is one of the biggest challenges, difficulties, hurdles facing the country. And the numbers are staggering. Over 40% of young people aged between 15 and 34 simply not in employment, education or training. But within all of this lies an opportunity, says my next guest. The rise of so-called emerging sunrise sectors, which she says are poised to transform the economy and create sustainable jobs. So I'm in conversation now with Tsego Bokaba, CSI Manager at the Momentum Group. Let's take a closer look at some of these transformative sectors. So Tsego, you've spoken about the sunrise sectors as key drivers of economic growth. What are they and why are they so critical?
Yeah, so the sunrise sectors are very critical because these are sectors that promise, or at least show promise, of a rapid growth. These are industries that have high growth rate, industries that will be able to produce more jobs, industries like the green economy, industries like the ICT space, the information and technology space. I think when you look at where we are as a country, just South Africa alone, we have a water crisis, we have an energy crisis. So those things would fall under the green economy. And if we can upskill young people, if we can train them in those sunrise sectors, like the green economy, like agriculture, like manufacturing, we know that this is where the jobs are going to come from, especially for young people. So we need to align our skills development programs. We need to align our education system to ensure that they at least are responsive to those sunrise sectors and to the market.
And all of that makes complete sense, but it does require, you'll agree, a huge paradigm shift as far as thinking is concerned. How does one start to re-pivot in order to seize the opportunity that you're outlining?
So it's going to take a lot of things. And one of them is collaboration between the private sector as well as the academia and the public sector. For instance, our TVET colleges, we know that these skills would predominantly come from TVET colleges a lot, but they are not well equipped to train young people in relevant skills with relevant equipment that industry requires. So you kind of need industry to partner with TVET colleges so that they ensure that curriculum one is up to scratch with the needs of industry, and they are well equipped with the necessary resources and equipment that meets the needs of that industry. But secondly, we also need to educate young people around these opportunities, because I don't think they know them. And if they know them, they are not attractive. Like, for instance, you take agriculture. Young people are not attracted to agriculture. So how do we educate young people and show them the potential that is in agriculture? Mining and manufacturing, for instance, these are industries where you have to lift heavy metal and equipment, especially at entry level, but there are jobs available, but they're just not attractive enough to young people. So we also need to do that education. When we're talking career guidance in schools and even in higher education, let's make them aware of the potential that lie in these sectors.
Notwithstanding the better matric results for 2024, all of this, of course, hinges on better secondary education. And the fundamental problem here is we're still not meeting the targets that we've set ourselves in terms of mathematics and science and the pass rate that we need.
Absolutely. I think that STEM education is very, very important. We need to ensure that we strengthen our STEM curriculum. We strengthen even our teachers. How do we support our teachers adequately so that they train young people in STEM? Because all these sectors that I spoke about, they will need a strong education system, a strong basic education system. And we need to put measures in place in how we support our teachers so that they are able to transfer education that is meaningful, education that is going to be transformative in the lives of the young people that they teach.
So you've sketched a very big challenge here. Where do you think the jump off point is? Where do we start?
Sure, that's a big one. I mean, I spoke about, obviously, there's a stagnant economy, that is, our economy is not growing, and that is the main challenge. But there's also an argument that says, even though our economy might grow, that is not going to translate into jobs for young people, especially. So a growing economy or growing GDP is actually decoupled from youth unemployment. So that's it's a whole new discussion altogether. But I do believe that if we can see a growth in our economy, then we will also see growth in employment, right? And I spoke about the skills and education that are not market responsive. But there's also a potential in entrepreneurship support. I think we need to meaningfully educate young people about the value of entrepreneurship and support them in their entrepreneurial ventures. How do we introduce education as a subject in basic education? And how do we do it meaningfully? How do we do it practically in a way that is empowering, in a way that is enabling for young people to upon completion of matric, start their own businesses, or even maybe while they are still in school, how do we support them start businesses? You see, so there's a huge gap that we experience as South Africans where entrepreneurship support and education is concerned. I'm told that in Germany, 80% of employees work in the SME space. And in South Africa, it's actually the converse. We have a lot of young people who will go and look for jobs in corporate South Africa and in government. And those two sectors are no longer producing jobs at a rate that we need jobs to be produced. So there is a huge opportunity that lies in entrepreneurship. And if we can support young entrepreneurs, break the barriers that are in entrepreneurship, as well as educate young people early on.
Just a final question. You've raised a number of important issues. Are you confident in the near term that South Africa can strike a new path in this respect?
I think it's going to take a lot of intentionality, if there is such a word, but we need to be intentional, we need to be deliberate, and we need to drive public-private partnerships, and also addressing some of the systemic issues that we have, enhancing access to information and resources. If we can get those basic things right, for me, we talk a lot as South Africans. We like to talk about things. We like to come up with subcommittees and committees and working groups, but there isn't really implementation. There isn't really action. So I'm challenging South Africans. I'm challenging corporate South Africa to say, how do we come together and act? We have all the information that we know. We have the research that is backing us. We know how successful countries have done it. So we kind of need to get to that stage where we are implementing now. I mean, this year we are hosting the G20 as South Africa, right, for the first time on the African continent. So look at that opportunity. We can show the potential of the township economy, or the potential that lie in the township economy, and how do we support those businesses in the township to ensure that they create jobs, and jobs that will be actually within reach for young people, that will not require them to take a taxi or a bus to get to Sandton or to big metros.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Tsego Bokabe, CSI Manager at the Momentum Group. I do appreciate your time. And that is our program for today and the week. We're back on Monday with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.